Super Science Me.
This 33rd episode of Super Science Me is a collaboration, or rather, it is a takeover. My friends Shaina Kapeluk, Ross Lipton and Ben Schur recorded and edited the following radio hour, full of music, their own compositions, as well as very old folk songs that they have recorded newly themselves or selected for us, full of conversations and of personal reflection of these last months of the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic and the lockdown. A situation we have all experienced, but every one of us differently and in different places. Ross is in Eugene, Oregon, Shaina in Philadelphia, and Ben in Washington, D.C. And I am in Vienna, playing this on the Viennese community radio, Orange 94.0. During this time, Ross, Shaina and Ben not only stayed in touch, but they continued to make music together. They are part of the band Tazio, that has just released a new album on Blight Records. You will hear some of their music in the following hour, and you will hear Shaina and Ross talking about the meaning and the history of some American and British folk songs where protagonists negotiate or try to negotiate with death not to take them. Often these ballads have been written and sung at times of epidemics. You are listening to the podcast version of this episode, where we can unfortunately only play small snippets of most of the songs that Shaina and Ross discuss for copyright reasons. If you want to listen to them in the full version, head over to the CBA archive of Communities Radios Austria, where you find the radio version ready to stream. Link in the show notes. I met Ross 3 years ago when he was living in Austria for a year, and I saw him again and I met Ben for the first time last summer when both of them were touring Europe and came to Vienna for a performance. Our regular mail exchanges with Ross not only always brings new great music in my headphones, but also helps me to understand what is going on in the US. And it is important to note that we planned this episode a few weeks ago, and they recorded their discussion a week before the brutal murder of George Floyd, an unarmed black man who died at the hands of white police officers. As Ross just wrote to me in a message, "This most recent act of racially motivated police brutality is unfortunately not new, but a culmination of the paradox that haunts America, a country that promotes the virtues of liberty and equality, in a reality in which some are deemed more equal than others. A country whose radical project of democratic self-governance was based entirely on its ability to take away freedom from others. The protests currently taking place in every small and large city in the United States are both a fight for justice in the service of racial equality, as well as the existential survival of the country's original tenants." So right now we are talking a lot about the Black Lives Matter movement and how it takes form in the US and in Europe as well. A few weeks ago we were of course talking a lot about our situation in lockdown and the pandemic, and this episode grew out from this conversation. Shaina and Ross' conversation you will hear just now also revolves around themes of isolation and the pandemic, but they approach these themes through very old as well as recent ballads. Sad songs, but also ecstatic ones.
A few weeks ago, in the middle of this pandemic currently gripping our planet, I took a drive out to the Umpqua Forest in central Oregon, a landscape of thick mossy trees, sequoia redwoods with their branches like monsters with many arms, and those noble Douglas firs, whose leaves look so thick and soft that to even watch them sway in the wind is to be comforted. And let's not forget those mossy madronas, whose trunks have the appearance of frozen lava. It wasn't clear if the forest was officially closed or open. There were signs that basically guilty you for making such a trip at a time like this. Signs like, quote, "We cannot promise you a COVID-19 free experience at the Umpqua Woods today. Enter at your own risk," end quote. But I wanted to be in this quiet place this day because it was a 1-year anniversary of Mr. Nelson's death. My beloved orange tabby cat, who I raised from infancy until he was 10, when he died of an undiagnosed mysterious illness. His sudden death took something from me, wounded me in a way that even my own father's death could not prepare me for. This beautiful, loving creature. I was so proud of him. So in love with him. Nothing ever brought me such serenity as feeling his sandpaper tongue cleaning my chin as his little body purred like a battery against my chest. I had adopted him with my then partner at the time, Caroline. Both the cats we adopted passed away last year. This fall, I moved to Oregon without a real job in mind, without having many friends nearby, all so I could be in the comforting presence of these royal evergreens. And today, I climbed through the Bryce Canyon Trail until I reached a small waterfall. With my back to the water spray, I could see the entire canyon, entirely covered with these dense trees and tall ferns. One could imagine dinosaurs roaming through this overgrown landscape. This place must have looked the same way a millennia ago, and this stillness brought me comfort. And I thought about all the suffering happening across the globe right now. Parents losing their children, children losing parents. How strange it was to know that my private sadness that has been with me since my cat's passing, that private despair was now a public, universal mood. Everyone was feeling loss. If not the loss of a person, then the loss of a world that will never return. I recall sometime in late March, I noticed some graffiti under a bridge by the Riverfront Trail in Eugene, Oregon. It read, quote, "March 10th, the day the world ended as we knew it." After my cat Nelson died, I was at least lucky to be surrounded by my bandmates and friends who encouraged me to focus on the one thing that ever brought me solace. The lease for my apartment in Philadelphia had ended and I didn't have any job prospects, so I decided not to renew it, although I didn't really have a better plan. My good friend Patrice was going to York for 2 months to study puppetry, so she let me stay at her apartment. My bandmate swiftly moved all of our recording equipment into her small unit and we got to work. And I must say, this act of making music together, it simply saved my life. And this is what music can do, give form to that which we cannot express in everyday language. And this made me think about this connection between times of terror and loss and the times that come in its wake. See, I play in a band called Tadzio. If you're a regular listener to the show, then you probably have heard some of our songs or instrumental pieces. I've always been surprised that the most popular songs in our set is a version of an ancient ballad that comes from the time of the bubonic plague. It's a ballad called Death and the Lady, which details a young woman trying to bargain with death itself. She promises death countless jewels, vast kingdoms, even a crystal staircase, but death cannot be deterred. Death comes for all. Some sooner than you think would be just, but the message of this ballad, it's always later than you think. Not only is it late, it has always been too late. We have played this song all over the East Coast, and a chill always seems to go through the room when it begins. People finally stop talking. Cell phones are put away. When I play the song, I don't even necessarily feel like I'm playing it, but that the song and its message is manipulating my own fingers. I simply fall into a trance. After all, Death and the Lady is a folk song. It doesn't belong to me or Shayna or Shirley Collins or Norma Waterson or any of the countless musicians that have made the song their own. Unlike other art forms, the beauty of a folk ballad is related to its universality, its ability to speak to what is essentially human. Try as we may, we cannot escape loss. To live is to lose, sometimes gradually, sometimes momentously. We cannot ever be done with the losing because the losing can never be done with us. In this way, the beauty of a folk song is like the beauty of those ancient trees, made soft by the moss, the slow and sudden passing of time is bound to their bark. In these ballads, topics of pain and loss become forces of nature, celestial bodies hovering over the human comedy. There is a line in a lyric written by Shayna that I think summarizes this sentiment for me. Quote, "I'm not saying that this absence feels like a loss. It just feels like a part of the sky." In a sense, I was interested to speak with somebody about how songs help us to do the impossible work of reckoning with loss, especially in times of collective loss, such as the Spanish influenza, the bubonic plague, cholera, HIV, and now coronavirus. I thought there would be no better person to discuss this entangled history between sickness and song than Shayna Kopeluk, who has studied the history of both American and British folk song traditions. But before that, I'd like to play you a song that we wrote recently, Shayna and I, that seems to capture this moment that we're living in, even if it was written a few months before. It's called Absence.
It's great to talk to you from this great distance. I'm glad that we're able to work together despite it all.
I was wondering, like, how do you define a folk song? I mean, folk music is music that, or songs that can't really trace to a particular songwriter. They go back to a distant past that like can't be reduced to like one auteur.
It predates the concept of genres. I mean, I think there were, for a long time, church music and secular music, really, were the genres. And I guess dance music. But balladry, the like subset of folk music that I have any kind of fluency in, is like music with, yeah, no attributable author. That's music that you are not dancing, just listening to. It's music continues to be sung because people remember the last person who sang it before they did. And if you don't know who sang it first, but you know that it's experience that people are continuing to have, and the impulse to sing it self-perpetuates with or without recording technology, with or without a printing press, it's storytelling music. And it's not like, oh, this thing happened to me last week, let me tell you about it. It's like, something happened to someone. Things happen to people. This may have happened to you. And in entering the space of the song, you're entering a sort of a timeless zone where suffering is not ahistorical, but like transhistorical.
I just want to talk a little bit about like, you know, a few years ago, we made our own rendition of sort of one of the classic folk ballads, Death and the Lady. I always felt like it's an interesting song for me to play, particularly when we play it live, because it's one of those songs where I was surprised how many people connected to our live version of the song. We played the song, you know, all over the Eastern Seaboard, and you know, if it's a good night, like, you really do see people affected by it. Like, what do you think it is about songs like Death and the Lady? I know there's a whole tradition of songs, and also the theme of Death and the Lady, which basically,
yes,
it's a woman trying to negotiate with death about, you know, giving her a little bit more time to live.
Oh, well, I think that's, if you're going to talk about universal experiences, not wanting to die is probably one of the most consistent human emotions. Basically, while you're alive, you got this short thing that you want to perpetuate to the best of your abilities. I think that song, when I'm singing it, I always feel sort of like I'm casting a spell on the audience that I learned from somebody else. It's very different from singing an original song, but you're watching the effect that song has, that song has been having. And I think what that song has going for it, and I think a lot of the songs we're going to listen to during this hour have going for them, is there's a sort of carnivalesque aspect, like death is the great leveler. This is a feeling that will occur in everyone's life. There will be at least one moment of needing or wanting to negotiate with the unnegotiable fate. And there's something sort of joyous in having it be a song. It's not happening to you. So you can listen and participate in this like wretched emotional weather, but know that when the song is over, it's like waking up from a dream. You're free. It'll happen later, but it's not happening to me now. It's, and Schadenfreude, it's this awful rich lady who has all this gold and jewels. So you kind of are like, yeah, she had what was coming to her. I think that one thing that pops up in a lot of ballads about death is that you feel some modicum of identification with the dying protagonist, but then some sense of safe distance from them. And I think that that dialectical tension is what makes the song draw people in, even now, you know. There's a massive family of songs, and there are many, many, many American versions of this song. But before there were American versions of this song, there were English and Scottish and Irish versions of this song. And there's an ethnomusicologist I admire immensely, Martin Carthy. He and his wife, who's also a music historian, Norma Watterson, have both espoused the theory that this song finds its root in the plague. And I think that a lot of, like, that's one of the sort of cataclysms of British history, and European history too, that when you're singing about the worst possible thing that can happen, you're pointing back to this sort of collective memory of death and dying being something that suddenly feels more inevitable than it's ever felt before. And the earliest versions of this song trace back to the 14th century. So the roots can be traced historically to the Black Death, and the bargaining is the sort of the core of this song that pops up again and again. There are American gospel songs where someone bargains with death. There are Southern Appalachian ballads. The sort of the stage among stages of grief where you think you can sort of negotiate your way out. And there's a great quote, I think this is Mattie Pryor who said it about another version of Death and the Lady, 6 feet of earth makes us all one size. Because the protagonist of the song, the human in this song is wealthy, there's a sort of a carnivalesque feeling of like, ah, now you're upside down. Now you're suffering like the rest of us. Now you know how we feel all the time. So let's listen to it. And then I'll talk a little about the songs that came after it.
As I was walking one day, I met an old man along the way. His head was bald, his beard was gray, his clothing made of the cold earth and clay. His clothing made of the cold earth and clay. I said, old man, what man are you? What country were you born in? My name is Death, cannot you see? All kings and princes must bow down to me. All kings and princes must bow down to me. I'll give you costly rich robes to wear. give me time in the light and air, and give me time in the light and air.
Speaking of Death and the Lady, many famous ballads emerged out of the epidemics that ravaged the British Isles and parts of Europe throughout the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. Ballad writers and those who distributed ballads were seen as infernal sources of contagion, even more so than theater. Because balladeers did not need to be sanctioned by the law, they could roam from city to countryside, spreading their songs without the censor looking over their shoulder. Ballads were also enjoyed by citizens of every class, from the barrister in London to the farmers of Sussex. Therefore, the cultural critics of the day likened those who sung and distributed ballads as vectors of disease. In short, ballads both expressed the stigma and pain of death in their music, while also embodying it. As a 16th century writer Philip Stubbs wrote, quote, "These basilics, these ballad sellers, these bad-minded monsters, brought forth like vipers by their mother's bane, with such lascivious lewdness, have first affected London, the eye of England, the head of other cities." End quote. To return to the current situation, concerts and other music-related public gatherings have been banned for the foreseeable future, at least in the United States. I don't necessarily disagree with such a decree, but I do think it's odd that certain events are allowed to occur, such as upcoming presidential conventions in the summer. In the coming months, I ask myself, will music gatherings become the pariahs that they once were in the distant past?
So, but what I want to talk about now is a later member of this song family, an American version of this song, because I feel like the vehicle that brought Death in the Lake to the U.S. is like the SS St. James Infirmary Blues. There are more versions of St. James Infirmary Blues being sung and that have been sung in this country than there are other Negotiating with Death songs. Some of these songs are about cowboys who've been shot. All of the earliest versions of the St. James Infirmary Blues are about a person dying of syphilis. Sometimes that person is a man, often a soldier, and sometimes it's a woman, usually a soldier's girlfriend who has a brief affair, and then she finds out, oh no, she loved the wrong man and now she's afflicted. And many of these versions of this song will talk about the Locke Hospital, which is it's not a specific hospital so much as a kind of hospital where lepers and people who needed to be isolated and kept in quarantine were treated. The Locke in Southwark, England was used for people suffering from venereal diseases, so that's often what they mean. And it's no longer used, but the first recorded use of the Locke Hospital song was in 1770, or the first written recording. Another thing that pops up in this song, every single version of St. James Hospital, the narrator says that they're going to die, and they talk about how they wish to be buried, and they describe their funeral and the flowers they want and the music they want. And I want to play a version of this song sung by Kate and Anna McGarrigle, so I'm going to put it on.
Early one morning at the St. James Hospital, early one morning in the month of May, I spied a young cowboy all wrapped in white linen, wrapped in white linen, as cold as a clay.
Now I want to go back in time. So that song is a more recent song about illness, but it's not a plague song particularly. And I do have some songs that refer explicitly to the Black Death and its effects on the lives of English people. So the first one, this one is one of the few really, really concrete. There are two women in this song whose grave is along a river that you can visit. The Great Plague struck Perth, the area of Perth, in 1645, 20 years before it did the same in southern England. And according to the tradition around this song, Betsy Bell was on her way to visit Mary Gray at the time of the outbreak, and they built themselves a shelter. They built a bower of rushes along the riverbank, and they would have been fine, only a young man who was in love with both of them was coming to bring them food and supplies, and he got them sick, and the three of them died, and there's a stone slab that was visible for a long time, but now it's under a lot of stones brought there by pilgrims. It's probably still there. It's just a matter of finding it. So I was talking before about Martin Carthy, who's an ethnomusicologist that I admire immensely. This is his interpretation of Betsy Bell and Mary Gray.
Betsy Bell and Mary Gray, they were bonny lasses. They built them a bower and young Burnside, they think it all over with rushes.
I think one thing that pops out to me now listening to it is the verse where it says they thought they would be buried in a churchyard among their relations, but they died by the riverside and they were laid out where they died and buried where they died. And I think that one of the things that is conveyed in songs about pandemics and epidemics and plagues is how what you imagined would happen, how you imagined you would die, how you imagined your life would wind down is being taken away. And whatever little story you had been telling yourself. And I think that's also a very universal fear and a very universal theme. You can tell yourself the story of where you'll wind up, but life can strike you down at any time.
It's also accepting the fact that you have to relinquish control.
Yes, yes. And I think that's where the carnivalesque aspect comes in. We're going to hear some songs later on that are almost ecstatic, but I think some of that ecstasy is born of the relinquishment of control, that like, okay, throw caution to the wind. All of the regular rules have been obliterated. I have a week to live. I have 6 months. What do I want now? And that is a kind of an ecstatic liminal space. And I think that is evoked in a lot of music. And I think it's a reason why there's so many songs. I personally, now that I can't leave my house, I've been playing the guitar for hours every day and writing so many songs because it's one of the few vehicles that makes my world feel bigger when it's shrunk to this tiny little apartment. I want to play another plague song. And it's my pet theory, but it's backed by science. I don't know if any of you listeners have ever taken oregano oil as an antibiotic, but it's a very, very powerful antibacterial. It also functions as an antiviral. It's one of the strongest herbal antibacterials. And thyme has a lot of thymol. Thymol is one of the terpenes in oregano oil. And there's a vast catalog of songs about how you should never lose your sprig of thyme. It is this precious thing that you should hold fast to. And I think Victorian ballad singers and parlor song singers and collectors perceive this as a metaphor, like something Ophelia talks about in her last moments, the language of flowers. But I don't think it's a metaphor. I think that the reason why thyme is so valuable is because it's a very strong medicine. So I'm going to play a version of the Sprig of Thyme. And this is an American version. Kathy and Carol, who were at the time this is recorded, a couple of teenagers from California. But this is proof to me of the capacity for an old song to absolutely drop the bottom out of the present and make anybody who's singing it sound like they're from a timeless place.
Once I had a sprig of thyme that did flourish both night and day, till at length came along a pretty plowboy, and he stole my thyme away.
And there's lots of other symbolic flowers in this song, like primrose and rose and willow. And I think that those tend to crowd into any song about plants. Like people, oh yes, rosemary, that's for remembrance. But the reason why thyme is always the titular herb in this song is, I think, because it was such a highly valued medicine. And I think that's why it's the valuable thing you should never lose. And some people say, oh, she's talking about losing her virginity. Well, you know, medicine is more important in a crisis than the mythic, the quaint fiction of virginity. Lots of things have proven themselves to be quaint fictions, but an antibiotic is really useful. There's no getting around it. So I want to play another song that is about herbs. And so this song, now we're not talking about the plague anymore. There's two songs. They were originally poems written by Rudyard Kipling, and they were set to music by Peter Bellamy. And they're about the cholera epidemic, which hit Britain, but also hit even harder in the British military encampments in India, where Rudyard Kipling was writing these poems. And this one is about, it's comparing the cholera epidemic to the plague. It's called Our Fathers of Old. And after we listen to it, I'm going to read some of the lyrics because it's so sarcastic. He's so sly and sort of snide about the faith that people put in herbal medicine in the past. But eventually, by the song's end, he realizes that at the great leveler, whatever it be, the bubonic plague, cholera, it will hit and the damage will be done whether you have archaic medicine or modern medicine. And the one thing that you do have is your fortitude.
Excellent herbs had our fathers of old. Excellent herbs to ease their pain.
Something that Kipling does a lot in his poetry where, like, he uses sarcasm in a way in which, like, you don't understand the full meaning of, like, the refrain until, like, the end of the song, in which all the sort of values that he's espousing in the first half are kind of turned on their head.
Yeah, I think he has an incredible capacity for satire. I'll read this part just because I think it's clever. Now it would be certain, as Galen says, and sage Hippocrates holds as much, that those afflicted by doubts and dismays are mightily helped by a dead man's touch. Then be good to us, stars above, and then be good to us, herbs below. We are afflicted by what we can prove, and we are distracted by what we know.
I think it's particularly relevant to our situation in which we are, the virus that we are sort of living through, the coronavirus, in which very little information is known about it. And
yeah.
I think we're, in a way, like these songs from these time periods in which very little was known about cholera when it was afflicting.
And hindsight is 2020. You can look back at remedies that people employed and go, that's totally crazy. That's a terrible idea. But here we are. With, you know, fully staffed hospitals and no resources doing crazy things to get by and telling crazy stories on TV that everyone has a different relationship to. The next song that I want to play, actually, so this is, I talked a little bit about this before, that sometimes the catharsis of knowing death is imminent, the catharsis of things being turned totally upside down by an epidemic, and the sense of there being some sort of divine justice that you can't escape can make a song really just kind of like shake you. And Elder Curry, who's the singer we're going to listen to next, this song is used as an example of one of the earliest examples of rock music. But it's a song about the Memphis flu. It's about the Spanish flu epidemic in Memphis in 1929. It's such an ecstatic song, but it's not ecstatic in a sexual way. It's not ecstatic in a romantic way. It's ecstatic in a spiritual way that is like transcended fear and is just burning right through. So I'll put it on. Conditional in the chorus, if you don't turn away from your shame. And it's like, all of you people who are listening to this song, you are still alive and you have a choice. If you act right, you're not gonna die. I think that one of the things that happens too with music that's relating to disease is there's a big story and a small story. And the big story in the ballad tradition is usually about damnation of some kind, or like an attempt to describe everything using, you know, some notion of good and evil. And then there's the small story, which is just a story about loss and about fear. A lot of songs are about the carnivalesque, are about the world being turned upside down, about the fact that anything can happen to anyone. And that whatever you think the wonderful thing that your life will amount to is, it's going to be dashed to pieces by unforeseeable tragedy. But I think that also there's something for me as a non-moralistic person, as a person concerned with ethics and not morals, there's a sort of like a pleasure in inhabiting briefly the moral space of the song and then waking up from it like I wake up from a dream, you know? Like I don't have to stay there, but the song exists. And in the moment when you sing it, you are like living in that little shape that it makes. And then when the song ends, you're free. I try not to sing songs that will perpetuate morals that perpetuate inequity. That always seems like an important thing to bear in mind when you choose songs from the repertoire. I think the one thing to say about ballads as well is it's by and large a women's tradition. And so it's a lot of songs that are cautionary tales sung to women by other women, warning them about the dangers of, say, sleeping with a soldier or marrying someone you don't know or working in a rich people's house far from your family or going out in the woods with somebody who's interesting. I think a lot of murder ballads are not really about someone being murdered. They're just like, don't go in the woods with that man. You could die. What they're really saying is you could get pregnant, you know? But like, death is a great, nothing's worse than that. And I think also like songs where someone is punished for lying or drinking, or I don't know, there's songs that deal with domestic violence and women fleeing from a household where someone is mistreating them. I'm like, okay, the morality of this song is still relevant to the lives of people everywhere. And this, there's nothing new under the sun, man. This is bad news that's still happening. And the songs are necessary because they're an escape route and a place where when you hear the song and you sing the song, you can feel understood, which is a kind of emotional security, like a trans-historical emotional security.
Going back to Death and the Lady,
yeah,
that's like one song where I don't really see a moral lesson as much as like an exploration of the inevitable.
I think that that song has a message, but I don't know if it's truly moralistic. I think that the message is just death comes for everyone, and there's no trick, there's no rabbit you can pull out of your hat that will stay its hand. There is a space within a lot of ballads. There's also a lot of ballads that are about people playing tricks on someone, or shape-shifting, or surprising someone, or like winning a game of cards that they seem like they're destined to lose. And it's that reversal that makes the song stick. It's not what you think. So when I assembled this version of Death and the Lady, I was drawing from the entire archive of versions of this song. And I took the last verse from a version of St. James Hospital that I really like, where she says, "Here lies a young girl cut down in her prime." And it doesn't, you never know how old this woman is or what her prime is. But ladies, make much of your time. Here lies a young girl cut down in your prime. Whatever time you have, use it. Do the thing that you need to do while you have this time, because it will always feel short, which is quite an exhortation to leave with on the radio or on a tombstone.
There's one song that sort of come up in our discussion that I thought, you know, we could play that I don't think is that well known, but kind of comes from the Caribbean folk tradition, a song, "Somebody Is Dying Every Day."
I looked yonder, what did I see?
Somebody's dying every day.
That's a great song.
I mean, it's true. It's always true. It's a universe, that's about as universal a truth as a song can possess. Somebody's dying every day.
That's straightforward. I mean, I can't claim to know the experience of the context of that song, but it communicates something that's very, I don't know, immediate.
And immediacy is also what you need when you're in a moment. And I think about Phil Elverum. Before he married, he wrote a lot of songs with lyrics. And then during his happily married years, he wrote a lot of really beautiful ambient music. And then after his wife's death, suddenly he needed to write songs constantly, and he wrote just reams of really vivid expressions of the immediacy of grief and loss. That's such a relatable compulsion to me. It's such an understandable compulsion. Okay, what am I going to do with this pain? I just have to keep making songs with it constantly, constantly, or I will lose my mind. And the songs will carry me out of it eventually if I keep writing them. That's why I write songs.
I think, you know, the act of working on music together, I mean, many times has saved my life, personally. And I just wonder, like, where do you think music is going to go post-COVID-19?
I'm a part of a group of songwriters that are submitting things they're recording at home for a Life in Isolation compilation that is getting longer and longer because the isolation continues, at least on the East Coast of the United States. And so I've been hearing a lot of songs about the present moment that have spoken to me. And I also think, like, post-COVID, there was a period in which I froze and became very sad. I was like, venues are shutting down, tours are on hold for the indefinite future. But I think that what I'm starting to see is the germplasm of a stronger and more urgent DIY music practice that can arise where a lot of the smaller venues that are shutting down have been. And I hope that that is what transpires, and I will do everything in my power to keep it possible. But I'm starting to feel like there will be a way for musicians to reach each other beyond video and radio in some version of live public performance. I'm hoping for that.
Something I worry about a lot because, you know, think about the experiences that got you into music when you were, you know, in your, you know, teenager or preteen years. It was these live experiences, right? It was being in a public space of other people experiencing music together. What can music look like? I mean, how can we express this sort of strange new world that we're living in?
There's like, there's the little picture. And there's the big picture, then there's this medium-sized picture, right? Like, you can look at a crisis and say, somebody's dying every day, right? That's the big picture.
Yeah.
You can look at a crisis and say, someone is dying in my house. I am dying. The people I am close to in my story, in my life. And then there is this, like, middle management, maudlin, middle of the road, like, I just want to write a song with no singularity so that it can appeal to as many people's experience as possible. And you can't start there. That's the thing. A song can start very specific and weather down from years of singing until it's very, very simple and speaks to a lot of people's experience. That song has been sung and sung and sung, and what it carries in it is that unutterable truth, and the song can utter it. And there's a lot of musicians who are stuck at home writing songs. If you have nothing else to do but work on music and you're in a cataclysm, I think a lot of powerful songs are waiting to be unleashed on the world.
We're about to release a new album next month, then.
Yeah.
Are there any kind of, like, songs that you're going back to that, like, were not written for this context, but just something that you think speaks to it?
Oh, man. Oh, my God. Where do I start? I feel like I need to look at a list or something.
I mean, for me, I feel like I'm going back to my comfort zone. There's something about the song Isolation.
Uh-huh.
A manic feeling that we're all enduring.
Every day I breathe, calls are alive from above, carefully washed for a reason, mistaken devotion and love, surrendered to self-preservation, from others who care for themselves, blindness that touches reflection, but it hurts just like anything else. Isolation.
And, like, we have to accept it. We can't live as a society right now.
Well, we can't. but we are.
We are.
That's where I'll leave this. Somehow, despite the fact of its impossibility, here we are doing it right now. My love goes out to you, listeners, wherever you are. I'm with you in the room. Recordings are with you in the room, and a song can keep you company like few inanimate objects. See you soon, as they say in France.
Super Science Me on Radio Orange 94.0. You heard Shina Kapeluk, Ross Lipton, an episode produced by Ben Schur. They are the band Tazio. Find all of their amazing music on Bandcamp and on the label Blight Records. Links in the show notes. Merci infiniment. Julia Grillmeier, thank you for listening and come back next month. Super Science Me.